Hey folks, this is your host, Paul Winkler. Thank you for listening to the show today. Before we get into the content, I want to tell you about a new workshop I'm hosting called Politics and Portfolios, How to Invest During Election Season. You can register for it at paulwinkler.com/politics. A lot of people are worried about the market this year, and I want to help you know what to do. We're going to look at historical data and academic research to explain how markets behave in election years, and we'll use easy-to-read charts and graphs. I'll be live on Friday, February 23rd at 12 o'clock. But if you can't make it live, register anyway, and we'll send you a replay link, so go check it out at paulwinkler.com/politics. Now, here's your show.
Welcome to the Investor Coaching Show, a podcast to help you get an insider's view of the financial world and escape common investment traps. We look at the financial news of the day and help you make sense of it so you can relax about money. And here's your host, Paul Winkler.
All right, we're back here on the Investor Coaching Show. I'm Paul Winkler, Evan Barnard, Ira Work. Evan, your wife goes and agrees with Ira. Come on.
Some people.
Come on, Cindy, really?
Some people just recognize natural brilliance.
I guess they do. I guess I'm just shut my mouth.
Why do you think we've lasted 30 years?
Come on, we have.
You know,
we've lasted quite a long time, too, all of us, the three of us. Good grief, yeah.
This is totally off the whole investing topic, but, there is a soft place in my heart for, like, the couple. It's Marley Matlin, and what was her husband's name? Worked for Clinton. James Carville.
James Carville
and Marley Matlin were, like, on opposite sides of the fence. And they'd been married for years.
That's not her name, is it?
Yeah.
Madeline?
I think so.
Oh, gosh. I can't remember.
Maybe that's the deaf actress, but I think it's Marley Matlin was her.
No, that's not it. It's not hitting me. But anyway, okay, keep going.
Well, anyway, when we were talking last about, the different administrations and how capitalism works and so forth, and we talk a lot about the U.S. market. And we don't often talk about the international, but I wanted to hit a couple of stories because...
Mary Madeline.
That's it.
And so right.
Marley is the actress, isn't she?
It was just driving me crazy. I'm sorry. I wasn't going to let that...
Or hard of hearing, whatever, yeah. Hearing impaired. This article came out of the Wall Street Journal. Japan's Nikkei stock average hits a record propelled by profits. And, Tokyo and others in Japan are making more than ever, helping stock prices reach a new high without bubbles. And one of the reasons that jumped out at me is I was stationed in Hawaii when the Japanese were taking over the world in the late 80s, before the 89 crash.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, prices were going crazy. They were buying all the hotels. They were building buildings and so forth.
Yeah, people were panic-stricken how much they were buying.
And the Nikkei was at around 38,000 or so in 89. And then, of course, it crashed.
Yeah,
and their benchmark stock average. This is from February 22nd. Hit a record high Thursday after 34 years of waiting. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the reason mostly boils down to one word: profits. And so I wanted to pause there because we talk about the academic research behind the portfolio, and we have a lot of data going back to 1926 for U.S. companies, international. When you start to go out of sample, as they say in statistics, we only have data back to like 73. England, I think we're back to the 50s.
1956, yeah.
And, capitalism is a universal thing. The laws work. And so what drives the stock price in Japan is the same thing it drives the stock price in the U.S. Mm-hmm. It's profits. Japanese companies are making a lot of money, and they're handing a lot of it out to their shareholders. In contrast to 3.5 decades ago, when the Nikkei stock average record highs last made headlines, no bubbles or magical thinking are needed to justify the new peak. Now, it's interesting there, the press, the bubble, you could call it a bubble after it bursts, but at the time, everyone agreed, that's a fair price for the company. I mean, the markets are efficient. If someone's going to sell the stock for quote unquote above what someone else might think, they either won't sell it or someone's going to agree with them.
Yeah.
Or the trade doesn't happen. And one of the things that jumped out was why are earnings so strong? Helped by a cheap yen and prodded by foreign activist shareholders, many Japanese companies have boosted their international competitiveness and shed underperforming units.
Interesting that they've got a lot of foreign activist investors. I think that's fascinating. So, you know, the idea being that a company is run for the benefit of the shareholders.
Right.
And the shareholders are saying, you guys better do what you came here for, which is increase earnings. And that is it. That is, in essence, what's been going on. The cheap yen helps out a lot because it helps boost the exports because it makes their stuff less expensive overseas. So there are other reasons that come into it. I'm sure everybody predicted the yen would be weak and that would be what would happen. You know, no.
Right. But what struck me is, you know, a lot of times when you're talking on the show or we're talking with clients or in a workshop of, you know, well, what drives profit? We have earnings, you know, minus cost of goods sold, fixed costs and so forth. And if the economy's in trouble, what do companies do? Well, they see if, okay, well, they might lay people off, they might refinance, whatever. Well, that's the same thing that has gone on in Japan. It's taken them a long time to get some of these things fixed, but that's what they've done. They've shed underperforming units. They've, you know, gotten more profitable. And as a result, the stock market, you know, is booming, so to speak.
Well, it was probably a bit of a surprise when the U.S. and some other countries decided to start getting competitive with auto manufacturing because nobody could beat the Japanese in the 1980s. And it was, you couldn't get U.S. manufacturers to get on board and get away from the planned obsolescence attitude that they had forever that, you know, here's the idea. We're going to make something that's going to last only a few years, and then you're going to have to buy a new one.
Yeah.
And the Japanese says, no, we'll make something that lasts a little bit longer, and you'll want our stuff, and you won't want their stuff anymore. And it took a while for that attitude to wash out, you know, so that's part of it, too.
Yep. And so they've had some inflation in Japan since 2022, and combined with a flow of money out of China, propelled the market's final push to the record. And so, you know, we've had several conversations about, you know, U.S. funds pulling money out of China. Well, some of the Chinese are pulling money out of China as well, or other foreign investors, and they're looking for a stable economy that's a little bit more predictable. What do investors like? We like certainty.
Yeah.
You know, we don't like uncertainty.
Yeah.
And so they're benefiting from some of the instability. And this was a great statistic. In 89, six of the top 10 Japanese companies by market value were banks. So six of the largest companies in 89
that's interesting.
Were banks.
Yeah.
Today, the top ranks are dominated by companies skilled in international business. And so corporations adapt, just like people adapt and so forth. And so the final difference is the more things change, the more they stay the same. The current, a lot of these gains were fueled by Shinzo Abe and his his run when he was prime minister.
Yeah, there were a lot of things that he did because they didn't want any inflation whatsoever. Right. And then he came in and said, no, we're going to let
And he retired in 2021 or stepped down or whatever. The current prime minister, Fumio Kishida, mentioned the stock market surge just once in passing in his speech January 30th, opening their year's parliament session, which is kind of like their State of the Union address. Only one in eight Japanese adults own stock.
Oh, really?
And so, you know, I'd asked earlier and, you know, we checked it out. So one in eight adults own stock in Japan. In the U.S., it's over one in two. Over half of U.S. adults own stock. And so even in their State of the Union address, even with this booming market, this guy didn't even mention it. Now, he's also largely unpopular, and you would think he would be touting, hey, we've got these, you know, the Nikkei's at record levels and so forth, but the Japanese aren't participating in that. More foreigners probably own Japanese.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. Go ahead, Aaron.
But that makes me wonder then, are more of the Japanese not buying individual stocks, and are they buying more, you know, like mutual funds? And therefore, getting more diversification.
I would think that they would be talking about just stocks being invested in the stock market in general.
I would too, mainly because I wouldn't say 60% of U.S. holders hold individual stocks. I would bet a huge percentage of those hold funds.
Correct.
I don't know the answer to the question.
Yeah, because I don't own any individual stocks,
right.
But I have a ton of, I own 25,000 25,000 stocks, but just not in the form of an individual company.
But it is quite possible that it is that they don't own stocks or mutual funds simply just because they have a much stronger, you know, if you looked at why Abe was such a threat to them. Abe, you called him. I don't know. I think I always pronounce it Abe, but the Prime Minister of Japan. But what the problem was with Japan is that they wouldn't allow inflation. And the reason they wouldn't allow inflation is because people would vote people into office that were anti-inflationary. Deflation was fine. Now, that's a death knell to an economy to have deflation if prices are going down. The reason they kept voting people in that were making sure that the money supply didn't increase at all was because they were on so many fixed pensions. So because so much of their retirement income, and they have an aging population, so many people are dependent upon that. They didn't want any inflation, which leads me to believe they probably didn't own a lot of stocks. They could care less about the stock market.
Could be, yeah.
So it's very possible that that is the case.
This final sentence goes to this out-of-sample argument as well.
Uh-huh.
There is a big gap between stock prices and the real economy, and that is why I cannot celebrate too soon, Niinami said. That's an economist in the article.
Mm-hmm.
This is the watershed year in which we must extricate ourselves from economic malaise. Now, reading through that article, we might change some of the names, but you could have said Biden or Trump, just depending on what time period you wanted to pick, or Obama or Bush or whatever. But the narrative is largely the same. Well, the market doesn't necessarily reflect public sentiment. It doesn't necessarily reflect economic data. We have these things going on. Companies are pursuing profits. That is just the universal story. It isn't just here in the United States that all of that goes on. That's why we diversify internationally.
Well, I think it's so important, as a final thought regarding this, it is so important, I think, to have the population of a country be invested in the stock market, because it reminds me so much of a presentation I sat through probably 25 years ago. And this guy was talking about setting up ESOPs for businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, if you give me two companies, one has an ESOP, employee stock ownership program, and one that does not, he says the one that has the employee stock ownership program will trounce the other one because they have a vested interest in the company succeeding.
Yeah.
And I think if you look at people investing in the stock market of the country that they live in, if they have stock ownership, like Americans have stock ownership, that shows you partially why we've been so successful as a nation, because we have a vested interest in making sure this dog thing
works. We believe in capitalism.
Yeah, we believe in it. Yeah. You know, and as much as you may think that we don't, we do. it's because the news will make you think that we don't. You know,
right.
There are certain people, you know, that they'll make you think that it's all falling apart. It's all gone. It's no good. But it's not true.
Yeah.
There's still a lot to be positive about.
Thanks for tuning in to the Investor Coaching Podcast. Now, you may be one of these people that's been listening and realizing, wow, investing, there's a lot more to it than meets the eye, and financial planning, tax laws constantly changing, and recognizing that maybe you might need some help in this area, but you don't want just anybody to help you out. So we have 10 offices in the Middle Tennessee area, and everything we do is fee only. We align our interests with your interests. So you can get an initial 15-minute phone call with any one of our offices just by going to paulwinkler.com/call. That's it. Every one of the offices is run by somebody with 20 plus years experience. They're all degree planners. They all have academic backgrounds in investing, and you can get the help that you need. So if you want to set up a complimentary phone consultation, just go to paulwinkler.com/call. And we look forward to seeing you soon.
All right. We're back here on the Investor Coaching Show. Paul Winkler, paulwinkler.com is the website. That is where you see all of the video, audio, the podcast is there. It lives there. You can go and check that out. And thank you so many people signing up for that podcast. And you just get a little thing every day, and you have a little topic. Here's what we're going to be talking about.
And I got so much feedback from some of the segments we've done recently on long-term care. We had some things on anxiety that was they got a lot of feedback on that one. So you can just I'm telling you, we cover just about everything here. That's just whatever we feel like talking about. That's what we're getting into.
We diversify.
We do. Yeah, you know, because this is life, man. You know, life isn't just about which mutual funds do I pick and how do I do that? You know, there's a whole lot more to the story than that. The other thing that is on there that you can check out, there we have videos that we're doing where we have workshops that are coming up, things that we have done in the past. And if you go to the webinars page, you're going to see a bunch of content there. You know, anything from Social Security to Medicare, you know, Medicare supplements, you know, how do you choose those types of things? And I've had a few people recently that have done some things and you know, some it was kind of sad because they had done things and then only saw the workshop after they had made a decision regarding Medicare and just wish they had listened to it a little bit earlier. It was really, you know, very costly.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. You know, some of the programs out there that you might be looking at and they sound really good in the commercials. Let me just put it that way. They're not necessarily so great in practice. So, you know, that's it there for you to check out. And then, you know, the Social Security workshop, things that you see these people doing around town, come out to our workshop and we'll give you a free dinner and give you a free lunch or free whatever. And then, of course, it's a sales pitch and, you know, bypass the sales pitch. Just go watch the workshop you're going to get the same, it's going to be better information. In my humble opinion, it'll be much better information. You can go on that website and look at paulwinkler.com. So, guys, what else? What else is going on? What else is going on? I have had a lot of people ask me about, you know, the savings and, you know, setting up, you know, their like emergency fund. For some reason, banking is a big topic right now. Interest rates was another topic.
Oh, sure.
I had somebody ask me about that and they said, Paul, what are interest rates going to do? And I said, well, let's say this. If everybody knew that interest rates were going to go down, that would mean that bond prices would, you know, shoot up because interest rates are going to go down. You know, so what people would do is they would buy bonds right away. And they would throw a ton of money at bonds right away before the interest rates went down. Yeah. And what that would do is it would increase the cost of bonds and the price of bonds, which would drive interest rates down, which would shoot them in the foot. And, you know, it just, you know, let's just put it this way.
Yeah.
And this lady that asked me this question, she was asking more for mortgage reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because we're going to get to the point where real estate is more affordable and interest rates are going to come down. And I said, you know, nobody knows. Economists don't know. I like to quote that study. I've got to find it again. It was like where 70% of economists predicting interest rate direction got it wrong. You got a 50-50 shot. Are interest rates going to go up or are they going to go down?
Odds. Yeah.
You know, you got a 50-50 shot. They're either going to go up or they're going to go down. And when they guess directions, they guess the wrong direction.
Yeah.
You know, it was so it's really, you know, try to predict the future is pretty much impossible in anything. But I hear, you know, real estate people trying to tell you, well, this is what's going to happen in interest rates. And I sit there and go, bless your heart.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We hear this word or the phrase, you know, knowledge is power. And actually, knowledge isn't power until you apply it
right.
or use it. You know, right. it's the possibility of power. And you know, we talk about in the workshop, if you Google investing, you may get like, you know, 3.2 billion hits and so forth. Mm-hmm. More people research black holes than they do modern portfolio theory.
Right.
And so, you know, they're asking the wrong questions in their quest.
Let's just put it this way. Your likelihood of being sucked in by a black hole is very, very much more unlikely than you retiring with no money.
Than being sucked in by an investment.
That's or being sucked in by an investment. Hey, this is Paul Winkler. Hope you enjoyed today's edition of the Investor Coaching Show. If you want to learn more about what we do, go to our website, paulwinkler.com. You can watch some of the videos there, and if you're not already a client, you can set up a free initial consultation. Until next time, I'm Paul Winkler, reminding you that I believe that more educated investors are more confident investors, and confident investors are more successful investors. Have a great one. Advisory services offered through Paul Winkler, Inc., an SEC-registered investment advisor. The opinions voiced and information provided in this material are for general informational purposes only and not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine what investments are appropriate for you, please consult with a financial advisor. Paul Winkler, Inc. does not provide tax or legal advice. Please consult your tax or legal advisor regarding your particular situation.